Hello and welcome back to the podcast on international medical graduates and their transition into the UK and the NHS. Today I have Manu Jamieson here with me, and it's going to be a different type of episode in that I won't be speaking to a trainee or a trainer. Manu is the Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Lead in the workforce team here in one of the trusts in Yorkshire. I'm very excited to welcome him onto the podcast to be talking about topics relating to racism and what we can do better as a workforce for our colleagues from minority ethnic backgrounds and what we can do to level the field for our international medical graduate colleagues. I met Manu at Yorkshire's first International Medical Graduates Conference and was very inspired by his passion for these topics, and I'm very excited to welcome him on today. So Manu, just handing over to you, would you like to start off by telling me a bit about your job role and your journey into it?
Absolutely. But firstly, thank you for those kind words. My passion obviously is driven by the personal impact that racism has had on me throughout my life, and the fact that I have a couple of kids who are mixed race. And it's very important for me to feel that they have a better opportunity in life than maybe I had that many years ago. So my background is very much that I am British. I was born and brought up in this country. I am mixed race. My mother's white, but my father is Sri Lankan. So I've experienced racism from a very young age, in the 70s and throughout the 80s. And then I've gone into the world of work, and I've worked in private industry for 30-odd years in HR. That's my profession. And, you know, I think I had a good career in private industry. I left the job in 2016. And actually, to be honest, I was going to take a little bit of time out. But my wife wasn't so keen on me taking some time out to enjoy a little bit of leisure. She wanted me straight back in the world of work. And actually, a temporary fixed-term contract was available working for in the NHS. And it was my first time to join a public company. And I thought, I'll give it a go and just see how it goes, just in the interim while I look for the right job back in industry for myself. And 6 years later, I'm still working in the NHS. And there's a number of reasons for that. And I would say that as an individual, when I went into the NHS with my private background, I think many people with that background thinks, well, I'll change the NHS because, you know, it's quite, how can we say, not as forward-thinking and as progressive as a lot of manufacturing and private companies can be. But it's only probably a number of years into your career that you realise that the NHS is such a large organisation, and it's such a complex organisation that trying to introduce change is so very difficult. You know, I went into an HR department and I saw some of the things that people did, and, you know, very clearly defined roles and didn't think outside their boxes, whereas I've been very much an HR generalist where you did everything and you didn't have separate recruitment teams, you didn't have separate OD teams, you didn't have a separate HR team that basically just managed the grievances and disciplinaries. You had all of that, and you know, I looked after Rock Health in my role. I would have contracts that would come in under me looking after catering and security and stuff like that, cleaning. So it was, my roles were very diverse. And when you come into an organisation like the NHS, where it's so large and the trusts are so large, so, you know, employing 6,000 to 10,000 people, I've worked in trusts with that range, that you end up doing very specific responsibilities. Mm. And I saw some frustrations, and I particularly was frustrated how I perceived that our BAME colleagues were treated, not deliberately, but just, I think, some of the systemic issues that ended up with them receiving less favourable treatment. And I've worked now, this would be my fourth NHS trust, and I've worked in HR in all of those. And I found it frustrating, and I thought that I could change from an HR perspective, because that's what I'd always delivered as an HR practitioner, change to organisations to improve those organisations. But actually, I found that very difficult to do in those specific roles, because you don't have that rounded authority to change. And so I've worked at trusts where you've had, for example, and so I'll talk about the Workforce Race Equality Standard that I guess a lot of our listeners won't be particularly familiar with, which is, you know, shortened to RES, and it was a set of standards that was established in 2015 to tackle what had been an issue for decades within in the NHS and had been recognised as an issue, that people from ethnic minority backgrounds both received worse treatment, whether it be from a disciplinary perspective or whether it be accessing of non-mandatory training and it being less available to them, to career progression. And, you know, there's a statistic that they measure under the RES is how much more likely a white colleague is to be appointed from shortlisting than a BAME colleague. And that number's 1.6 times more likely. And in some trusts, it's significantly higher than that. And actually, that's the national number. And that number hasn't changed in the 7 years that we've been measuring RES.
And you mentioned the BAME colleagues. I'd just like you to clarify the acronym, if that's all right.
The acronym stands for Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic. There will always be debates about terms like that, encompassing such broad ranges of different ethnic backgrounds. I actually, technically, as a mixed race person, probably aren't really covered in that because I'm not black or Asian. I'm mixed. I am a minority ethnic person. I don't lose any sleep over that. I know some people do get quite upset about it and think that it undermines their particularly unique characteristics. And I get that. And I think there was a report done a couple of years ago, I think it was the Sewer report, that suggested that we should not use BAME and we should refer to people as ethnic minorities. And that's great. But actually, what you have to do, though, is change the data reporting. Because if the data reporting doesn't reflect that and is consistent, then it's pointless. Mm. So you get to the question of, you know, my trust employs 17% BAME staff. That's a significant number, and that's a number people recognise. If you start breaking that down to say, well, 2% are black, 6% are Asian, of those, 3% are Pakistani origin, 2% Indian origin, 1% other South Asian origin, I think you lose the perspective a little bit because it becomes granular detail. And I get to some individuals that might be important to them, and I'm not dismissing that. But actually, the significant number is we're nearly 1 in 5 BAME staff. And those people underwrite the running of our trust and the efficacy of our trust from a medical, clinical background. Without them, because actually when you start looking at the numbers in clinical terms, that goes up. Because the admin teams would be significantly higher numbers of white people. Without those people, we don't run safe, efficient NHS services. I'm not happy with BAME. But I think unless you can change the data recording to encompass things like that so that people recognise the significance of the numbers, I think you lose that.
I think I've just opened a can of worms
there. I saw a debate. Somebody had picked somebody up for using the term BAME on a health inequality forum that I'm on.
Yeah.
And I was nearly tempted to dive in, but I bit my lip and thought, don't go there, Mano. Just don't go there.
Don't open that can of worms, yeah. So this podcast focuses specifically on international medical graduate doctors transitioning into the NHS. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to focus on in this episode today was that transition process. And you've had a lot of experience with HR. Mm-hmm. HR is the front-facing, I would say, stakeholder in the IMG mm-hmm. transition process. They are the first people very often that IMG colleagues will be contacted by, mm-hmm. even before they arrive in the UK and start their jobs. And there's so much potential for that team to make that transition as good as it can be. You've mentioned there that there are a few challenges in that sort of very siloed working, even mm-hmm. in the HR department. From your experience, what do you think HR teams can do to reach that potential of making that transition as good as possible for our IMG colleagues?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Raquel, because I think there's that expectation that HR is one, so therefore thinks in a joined-up manner, probably doesn't reflect the reality. So what you have is the international medical graduates, when they're having their first contacts with the HR team, they're actually recruitment teams. And what they're probably dealing is a very transactional recruitment person who isn't looking beyond the how do we get you here what documentation do I need to prove that you've got the right to work here? How do I do the sponsorship to get you here? How do I establish that your medical credentials are legitimate and all of that sort of stuff? And then how are you going to get in the country? When are you going to arrive? And, you know, I might help you get find some accommodation when you first get here. But they're not thinking in a broader term of how do you wrap around that, because that's not necessarily their job. And I think that's the bit that we miss out. I'm not sure every organisation, so I think it's a bit hit and missy depending on where you work. Informed that my colleagues south of the Humber actually have a good system of wrapping around their international medical graduates to bring them into the organisation. I'm not sure all organisations do that. And I think that's something that we should be working on in terms of when we're looking at recruitment from an EDI lens, which is one of my responsibilities. It goes beyond just saying, how do we make sure people get the opportunity, to actually, how do we introduce people? So we've got a system with our nurses, many of them are internationally educated, a lot of them come from the Philippines, where we've appointed specific nurses who go down and organise the transport, and then they pick them up at Heathrow, and they bring them to the area, they help them with the accommodation, they have little packages of food. And I don't think that quite translates into our international medical graduates in the same way. And I think that's important that we should do that, wrap round. And I think, you know, HR has a responsibility to sort of pull that together. Less at the recruitment stage, it's more setting out for the recruitment team what they need to do. And then maybe the local HR, whether it be the HR advisors, managers and business partners who are embedded into the care groups. But again, international medical graduates aren't necessarily assigned to a particular care group. Whereas you can do that with nurses, because they're qualified nurses when they come across. Obviously, the international medical graduates come under HEE and go through the junior doctor training at that point. And it's divorced from the actual trust. So they won't just stay in one trust, they'll move around trusts. And I think that's the bit that, you know, somewhere along the lines we have to join up so that they have a better experience.
Thank you for summarising very succinctly the complexities of the different stakeholders involved mm-hmm. with the IMG doctor recruitment and onboarding mm-hmm. transition process. I agree with you. It sounds like there has been a lot of good work being done in different regions mm-hmm. of the country. And part of the reason of coming up with this podcast project was having a central resource to get different people's perspectives, and hoping from there we can open up these important conversations to make things better.
Yeah. I'm hoping that something that the integrated care systems that we've just introduced and the integrated care boards will actually get on board with and maybe own, because I know HEE tried to do it, but the problem with HEE is they're not technically the employer. And actually that employer will change depending on where an IMG is working at a particular point in time. So the trust that they're working in pays them, then they move to they rotate to another trust and their pay goes to that trust. And HEE are an encompassing body that is going to cease to exist anyway because it's being merged into NHS England. And how that works, who knows?
Yes, we've got very interesting times ahead, and depending on when the listener listens to this podcast, there might not be HEE anymore. So I guess it's important to keep up to date with stakeholders that are involved with that process. Thank you. That's very interesting. At the beginning, you mentioned the word change and how difficult that mm-hmm. is to achieve in a large system, in a large working environment. I understand you're working on a project relating to racism, and I was wondering if you could share a bit more about that.
Yeah. So, because it's an initiative, it's a change initiative that we've introduced at this trust. So our trust has taken an anti-racist stance.
Excellent.
And has launched some tools to support that. So we have introduced Zero Tolerance to Racism Framework, which is a 30-page document which explains exactly what racism is. And we've then also introduced a reporting tool, which is a QR code that will download a form that you can fill in on your phone and report incidents of racism. We then have established separately to that something that we call the Circle Group. So the reports come into the Circle Group. The Circle Group assess them. They discuss it. The Circle Group has mixed skills. So there's myself on it. There we have our staff network chair for the BAME network. We have the Freedom Speak Up Guardian. We have a senior HR input. We have our security manager, because he deals a lot of the issues around patients. In total, there are six of us. And we discuss each of the reports. And then we go back to the individuals and say, right, this is your report. This is our view. Does this meet your expectation of how you would want to resolve the issue that you've reported? And then we triage that. Now, that might be that we end up having discussions with people to explain maybe a microaggression and the impact that it's had on somebody, or we might triage it into a formal HR process because we believe that somebody's been overtly racist, or we triage it to the patient experience team when we talk to patients about whether we can continue to provide their care, bearing in mind some of the things that they might have done that would contravene our anti-racism stance. And that's actually quite, I think, a significant thing in the NHS, because whilst the NHS has lots of people say we have zero tolerance, they don't know how to implement that, and they don't know how to tackle patients. And I say we, but actually you all work in the caring profession, and what you want to do is provide the best healthcare to the service users. But they have to follow some rules as well. And the NHS isn't a separate place where you can commit a hate crime and get away with it, where you wouldn't get away with it if you were in a restaurant or something like that. We have to establish that, because I think that hasn't been established, and people feel that they can get away with it, and actually they do get away with it. And I think we need to provide that level of support to all of our BAME colleagues. And I get that international medical graduates probably don't quite, as they first come across, appreciate racism in the same way maybe I have done, being brought up as a brown person in a white society all my life, and therefore witnessed my family, my friends, myself probably not benefiting from the colour of our skin, but actually seeing maybe, in my case, white colleagues who I've worked alongside maybe having opportunities to have careers that I might haven't had, possibly because they are white. I'm not saying that for a fact, but that, you know, that's the sort of thing that happens. And I think it takes a while for the international medical graduates to understand that. I hate to say this, but I think by the end of the first 2 years, they will all understand more about what racism is than they did when they first came here, because they will all have probably experienced some of it, whether it be from colleagues, whether it be from managers, supervisors, whether it be from patients. I think it would be very difficult for an international medical graduate not to come across that.
And that's a huge reason today why I wanted you on the podcast as well. It's to share your tips. So you've mentioned there microaggressions. What are they? How should an IMG react to that?
I think the most obvious microaggression people will experience probably be from patients who say, can't I have the white English guy who speaks with an accent I can understand? They might not put it quite as blunt as that, but that's what the meaning will be. And I suspect most people who come as international medical graduates, for whom English is probably a second language, who speak it with an accent will experience that. And even if they don't speak English as a second language with an accent because of the colour, they probably still will experience that, whether it be in the GP, where it's the 80-year-old lady who comes in and wants the white doctor, whether it be in A&E, when you know somebody's come in and it's their health, so all they want to do is to be sure that they can understand what somebody's telling them to do, so they want an English person who speaks English in an English accent or a British person to have those conversations. But what they don't understand is what the impact is that on individuals. And, you know, a lot of our international medical graduates actually are the best of the best from the countries that they come from, and are extremely bright, intelligent, well-qualified people. And it's an insult. And actually, it wears down on them. So my tips for people are, you know, I'm not saying report everything straight away the first thing time something happens, because I get that you don't possibly want to put yourself in that position. What I am saying is make contacts, be close to each other, openly have these discussions, get to the stage where if you're openly having them and nothing's changing and you don't feel that, and it's starting to undermine your confidence and your actual professionalism at work, that's the time to then start to escalate it. And, you know, talk to a supervisor. If you don't think you're getting anywhere with a supervisor, report it more formally. Obviously, at our trust, we have that tool, and we would ask you to do it through that, because I think that will then manage that with you to reach better outcomes. I would encourage you to join networks. So any trust that you work in will probably have a BAME staff network. Join it. Go and listen to other people. Talk to people about that. Make contacts. You know, network. BAPIO, which is the specific Indian Association Medics, it's a national one, network. I would encourage anyone who can to join that or something similar, so that they've got those contacts. And actually, some of the people who've been through that 20 years before are there to help support them and actually say, well, this is how I dealt with it. And I would encourage people to take up all of those contacts, because actually I think talking's important. I think if you bottle it up and you just go home and you feel really bad, and I've had stories where people have told me that they've come across, they've worked in this country, they've been treated appallingly at work. A person told me that during the pandemic they came to work and then went home and they cried every night. and went on the phone to their family on FaceTime and just cried, and the family saying, "We'll come home," but they wouldn't come home, but they were so miserable. And that's a horrible story to hear. I would say to anyone who's thinking that they're getting in that position, you need to talk to people. You need to reach out.
That's very powerful, and it is hard, the IMG transition process. A lot of people move here without any family, and there's something there in what you were saying in creating that safe space for you to discuss. And even in the workplace, it's about being the senior clinician aware when you've experienced a microaggression. So my ethnicity is Chinese, and I experienced a racist comment. Been in the UK for quite a few years by then, and it still didn't land. And I was talking about it in the break room, and all of a sudden the senior consultant, who I didn't realize was sitting there, stood up and said, "Who made that comment? Which patient made that comment? Because we need to have a chat." While I was shocked, for me that was very reassuring, knowing that I was in that safe space at work, and that was very encouraging as well.
Yeah. Now that is very encouraging, because actually one of the things that we're going to try to get people to do, and it's not easy, is to go away from being the bystander where you might, if something happens, you'll give a statement and you'll say, and you know, you think you've done your bit because you've corroborated something. But actually what we want our white colleagues to be is upstanders. So when they witness that, they don't come across as white saviours, but they intervene. And they say that's wrong. Or they let it go, and then they come and support you and talk to you and say, "How can we deal with this?" You know, upstanding is far more important. So if people really think that they're allies, the BAME staff, they have to upstand when they witness things. They can't just be a bystander. We've got lots of examples of that. One of the things in our framework is an induction session where somebody had put themselves in a little test. They called themselves KKK, and there were two black African doctors, and that clearly was reference to the Ku Klux Klan, which is a notoriously racist organisation in America, and that was a terrible thing to do. Somebody was facilitating that induction, didn't say anything, let it go.
And sometimes it's the things that isn't said that's more hurtful than the things that were said, isn't it?
And I do think that the individual says the thing that disappointed them the most was the person, the white person facilitating that, didn't say anything. And I can't believe they didn't recognise it.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said there of the person who was facilitating it might have recognised it but didn't have the tools in the toolkit.
Yeah, and that's part of our framework, is to talk about giving the tools. And we have got, you know, we are doing a lot of training to give people the tools to actually know how to challenge. So we have allyship training, we have anti-racism training. And if you read the framework, it will give you some guidance on what to do in those certain circumstances. But it goes beyond that for us as a trust. If that person doesn't do it, then there's an issue with that person that we need to talk about their performance. Because actually, that's poor performance if you let something like that go.
That's a very strong stance, and I especially appreciate that what you've been working on is essentially a structure, so very similar to the exception reporting structure of when a junior doctor or when a colleague experiences it, there is that upward structure of escalation, and that creates that safe space, doesn't it?
It does, and safe space is a big issue. Psychological safety is a big issue, and I get that for the junior doctors and the international medical graduates. They don't want to come in and rock the boat if they feel that's the way it is. And one of the disappointments will be that they will talk to senior BAME staff who are maybe previous international medical graduates and will say, "Well, I just put up with it. I would recommend that you do the same." And I don't think that's right. I experienced a lot when I was younger that I don't want my kids to go through, and anything I can do to change that, I will do. And I think everybody should take that. And I feel the same about junior members of staff who are BAME. You know, they shouldn't have to go through what I went through. And I think all senior medics should take that stance. I went through it, it was wrong, I'm going to do what I can do to make sure nobody else goes through it. Unfortunately, that's not the stance everyone takes, but it should be.
That's a strong message, and as you mentioned at the beginning, change is difficult, and that's why we're hoping with the initiative that your team has been working on and with projects such as this podcast, it's opening these conversations, making people aware, explaining the difference like you did between bystanding and upstanding, and giving more people the tools in their toolkit to stand up to microaggressions and racism when they see them. Because we're coming to the end of this episode, and to wrap it up, what advice, in a few sentences, would you say you have for a new or incoming IMG from your perspective, with your experience?
Right. I don't know that I do a few sentences, as you've probably picked up, Mikael,
that's
but
fine.
I'll give it a go. What I would say to them, I recognise that there will be times when they will experience things that they might not want to flag up, because they are worried that they might be reporting somebody who has a direct impact on their educational achievements and their abilities to qualify fully and that they might just want to let things go. I can't sit here and say, well, no, you must do and we'll support you and it will be all right. I can sit here and say, we'll support you. I can't promise that it'll be all right. There are lines, and what people have to understand is what their own personal lines are that they won't allow to be crossed before they will flag something up. And you shouldn't think that somebody can treat you however they want because they're making the decisions on your career. Because actually, if they are treating you appallingly, then we will address them. I can only say that for my trust. Yeah. I can't commit that for other people's trust. I can commit if people still want to use our reporting tool to report something, we will have those discussions on their behalf with the other trust to say, these are the things that are happening and that's coming through our reporting tool, and really you should have one like of your own.
It's really good and reassuring to know from someone in your position saying that work is being done and change might be slow, but mm-hmm. it is coming because these conversations are happening. You're being commissioned for this role and it's important.
Yeah, I think it's one of the benefits of the COVID pandemic. I think that there's been a recognition that actually our BAME staff put themselves at a risk that their white colleagues weren't. I'm not saying they weren't, but we all recognised that there was a worse outcome for BAME staff if they contracted COVID. I personally experienced that with 3 nights in hospital and COVID pneumonia. So I know that we as a country and as an NHS nationally are in the position that we're being challenged by that, because people are saying, why should I do that and then put up with all of this other crap? Yes, you clapped for me on the steps a couple of years ago. Now I don't even get a proper pay increase. And now I still have to put up with racism. And I think there's a mood in the country for change. And, you know, the Race Health Observatory are challenging the NHS senior hierarchy. I think it's coming back down through the hierarchies that actually, you know, Black History Month was action now. Those sort of things are now starting to be said. Actually, we can't continue to put up with this, because actually this isn't new. This has been around for decades. People have tried to put things right but haven't known how to. Mm-hmm. It's not about having strategic meetings where people discuss the ills of racism. It's about action. What are we doing that's going to make people's lives different?
Well, that's an excellent first step, isn't it? That reporting. Mm-hmm. And it's making people feel empowered through the surveys, through the reporting tools, yeah, such as what you've talked about. You've mentioned there a senior hierarchy, and that brings me on to my next question. What advice do you have for educators to IMG colleagues to better support them in their transition?
There's a number of things, but the first thing is educators need to understand that this hierarchical thing that they have in medical education, it is causing some of these issues. So you have to go out of your way to you know, you recognise that someone's moved halfway around the world to come and work here. Ask them how they're getting on. Talk to them, interact with them. Don't say, oh, well, I spoke to these two white colleagues because they were registrars and that was only a junior doctor, and of course that junior doctor doesn't get as much of my time. That's archaic, and actually not understanding that that junior doctor probably needs a little bit more time and effort. The other thing is, we have this assumption that people should understand the NHS after 2 weeks induction. That doesn't happen either. It takes years to get the NHS. Anyone educated through the British system has probably had 7 years training to be a doctor to understand the NHS. Somebody who's trained in another country comes across and within 2 weeks is expected to be at the same level. No, they're not. And we really have to recognise that and support that and make more of an effort to understand that people will take time to adjust.
Indeed. The NHS is very complex. I mean, even yes, if you did a placement in primary care for 6 months, if you go into secondary care, it's a whole new world.
It's a whole new world. There's virtually no relationship between primary care and secondary care. You know, I don't know what to say about that. It is very difficult for new people coming in to not understand that. Don't get me wrong. I know personally a couple of friends of ours whose youngsters are going through. I think they're going through training to be junior doctors, and they still struggle a little bit. But they've been through our whole system. Yeah. At least they know, understand what they don't want to do.
Yes, that is true. And sometimes it's asking about, well, what do you not want to mm-hmm. do? And that might be the very first question someone asks, or an mm-hmm. advice that a supervisor gives. And that brings me on to my last question. What advice do you have for staff members working in the NHS who will be working with IMG colleagues who have just started?
Be more empathetic. Be more understanding. Be more supportive. Don't roll your eyes and think, oh, here we go, we've got to train another one. you know, actually the time that you invest in the international medical graduates will, you know, you might personally not see the benefits of that, but the organisations that you work for will, the entirety of the NHS will. We aren't training enough doctors in this country through our system. So if we can't introduce the international medical graduates, our system will fall over. And take a holistic view and understand that and do everything you can to support the international medical graduates that you come across. And yes, that might be a different one every 2 months or something. And it might be that investment of time and effort to get them up to the right scratch, but please do it. Because the benefits that our entire society will reap from that are worth it.
There's something there about each and every member of staff that the IMG colleague comes in contact with has the power to to make their transition just that bit smoother. Because there's many things we can't change, including the food and the weather.
Yeah, no.
but the things we can.
But what you do get is these, how can we say, cabals of people who start to whisper about someone, and it comes back to a senior person who almost seems to take it as gospel when everyone's saying, well, they're not doing a very good job. And actually, that's not necessarily the case. And also understand, people can only do their best. And I am an inclusion manager for everything. It's not just about racism for me. It's about everything else. If people are included and they feel that they belong and can engage, they are going to be far more productive. Yeah. And that's what worries me about a lot of the international medical graduates. They come over as the brightest of the brightest. But if we don't give them the opportunity to shine, sometimes they don't. And it's not necessarily something that's conscious on their part or a lack of capability.
Yeah.
It's people get put into dark spots by some of the things that happen to them.
It is very much about the environment that we can create, and anything we can do, be it in any of our roles, be it a member of staff working with them, an educator, a fellow colleague, anything we can do to create and contribute towards a more supportive environment. I think that's where we can start seeing and making a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, Manu, for joining me today.
You're more than welcome.
I really appreciate your time and you coming to chat about topics that we're both very passionate about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hello again, and thank you for listening to this podcast. The introduction and ending music is called Happy Day by Stock Music and was obtained from Pixabay. I would appreciate any feedback from you as a listener. Please complete the feedback form in the link attached to this episode, and feel free to drop me an email or reach out via Twitter. I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and I hope you have found this episode valuable in improving your knowledge around topics relating to international medical graduate doctors and their transition into the NHS. Goodbye for now.